Some of you have been with me in sessions, and this will sound like some continuation, except that it's really going to be discussion and not monologue. Others of you have not been. Either way, let me simply say that we've been, not only my sessions, but sessions that Joel and David particularly have been doing, the two Bible studies that Larry Rasmussen had particularly, have had among them as one common theme the business of trying to persuade ourselves that we are in fact in community with more people than we are aware of, or at least that we ought to be in community with more people than we are aware of. And today, both yesterday and today, I tried to deal with this kind of tension between those impulses that want to isolate us from each other, to exclude each other or create a lot of space, versus those impulses that try to be drawn to each other and to want to create or to experience community. What I thought we'd try to do tonight is to shift from the kind of rigid logical lecture style to a kind of a collage of some images out of art forms, particularly out of movies and television, that would give us a kind of a way into discussion this evening about this theme that we could call the quest for inclusiveness or in search of each other. For those of you who have been using the term inclusive primarily in terms of issues of equality of men and women, I just simply need to say I'm using it more broadly. Maynard said it right tonight. I'm using it more in the sense of how do we reach across the kind of traditional barriers that are racial or sexual or ethnic. How do we reach across those barriers and develop more of a sense of commonality? If there's a text for tonight, it is a borrowing from and reapplying a piece out of the fifth chapter of Ephesians. That's the text that you often hear quoted at weddings, the one that talks about the duties of husband and wife toward each other. The passage I want to pick out is just lifted out where Paul falls back on what for him is a truism. So he doesn't have to defend it. He simply says in the middle of an address to men about how they ought to love, how a man ought to love his wife, Paul drops in this little gem when he says, "For no man ever hates his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it as Christ does the church." Let me do it again. "For no man ever hates his own flesh." I think Paul meant to say, of course that's true. No person hates his or her own flesh. The problem for us is that we have tended to want to repeat the issue of Genesis 4 and of the Pharisee in the parable of the Good Samaritan, or that led to the parable of the Good Samaritan. That is, we have always wanted to try to limit what constitutes the other part of our own flesh. We have tended to narrow the range of who we are really one flesh with. Obviously now I'm not using the passage in the marriage sense. What I hope we can talk about tonight is whether there is a way to help us get beyond the narrowing, to reach out in a more whole kind of way, to count more people more fully as being of one flesh with us, so that then it could come to play, as Paul says, that no one ever hates his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it. That can kind of lay the background. I thought we'd try to use some images, some illustrations out of movies and television and that sort of thing as a different way of coming at it tonight. Earlier, for those of you who were in yesterday's session, I used one of them. Let me repeat it again quickly. That's to take the original All in the Family from television, not the one that happened after the original cast mostly left. That was a throwaway, but the original one. I think it was a fabulous prophetic piece of television because on the one hand, it took a very narrow, bigoted, excluding kind of person, Archie Bunker. and throws him into a situation with a wife whose range of experience isn't much broader than his, but whose instincts are much more compassionate, gives him a daughter who is who has to commute between his biases, which she can't buy, and a kind of a liberal exposure she's getting out in the world, and then manages the dramatic device of bringing Meathead in, Michael in, because he can't afford, because he wants to marry Sally Struthers and he can't afford to provide a home for her. So here Archie has the antithesis of everything he stands for, living right smack under his own roof. It's a gorgeous illustration of the kind of tensions between idiosyncrasy and community, between isolating factors and gathering factors, and it's a tribute to Norman Lear's own vision. I happen to think that he has some ethics about him and some commitments, and it's a tribute to his sense of integrity that he manages to keep them under the same roof, and that they manage somehow to live with each other in spite of. There is that in spite of quality. If Larry had gone a step further in the Genesis 3 account the other morning in Bible study, there is a line in Genesis 3 when God is speaking to Eve and he says, "And yet your desire shall be for your husband." The "and yet" has the "but," has the "boy, it's going to be a lot tougher than it would have been if you hadn't messed everything up, but still," has that "but still" feel about it, and all in the family had that "but still" feeling about it, but still they managed to live together. And I don't know if you remember seeing the particular All in the Family episode in which Michael and his wife are leaving for the West Coast, where Michael has taken a teaching job, and it is their last, they're moving out, and somehow they've managed that she and baby and Edith are all outside, so it's only Archie and Meathead left in the house. And they're trying to figure out how to say goodbye to each other after all these years of civil war. And it's a fabulous kind of thing. They a kind of gruff exchange, and Archie doesn't really want to have to deal with it, and Michael really doesn't want to leave it unfinished. And then suddenly they turn and embrace each other. And it's, you know, it's that kind of feel. Well, that's one illustration. Since I've already described that one and spoiled it for discussion, let me introduce a second one and let you talk about it. And that's Fiddler on the Roof. I think Fiddler on the Roof is another fabulous piece on the matter of relationships. And I guess, Ken, let me just see. How many of you have seen the movie or the play? Ah, good. Enough so we can use it. Let's use it for a little bit. What do you see of the excluding and including processes in Fiddler on the Roof? Let's just see you talk about it a while.
Well, there's them and us.
Yeah.
And them is all non-Jews.
Yeah.
And us is all Jews.
Yeah.
And my daughter can marry anybody as long as it's one of us.
Yep.
She goes out and marries one of them, then we have nothing to do with her.
Yeah.
We don't mention her name in the house, right?
His line after the one daughter marries the Russian is, she's dead.
Right, she's dead.
We have other children.
But on the side, the mother embraces the daughter.
Yeah.
Right in front of the whole audience.
Yeah.
It's like, it's forbidden. It cannot be done. It's impossible. But yet we still love our daughter.
Yeah.
And the love comes through.
That's one. That's a key one. Name some more. Pick some more pieces out of Fiddler. Try Tevye's monologue when he talks with God.
Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say.
The classic business about saying to himself and God on the one hand, but on the other hand. I loved the one where he had the arranged marriage to a guy he despised too, except the guy at least had money. And then he has to go on this conversation with himself. He says, on the one hand I gave my word, and he's a good man, and he can provide for her well. But on the other hand, she loves the tailor. You know, and he goes back and forth on that thing. That's the humanizing, the business of trying to sort out what people need as over against the prejudices he'd grown up with. Try some more out of Fiddler.
Well, the relationship between heaven and God.
Yeah.
The going back and forth, you know, at other times too.
Just fabulous lines in there when Tevye is talking to God. You know, and particularly when he's saying, you know, why are you doing this to me? That kind of thing.
Well, his wife too, do you love me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Interesting, Tennessee Williams picks up that same kind of theme in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. A husband and wife who hadn't dared to believe they really could love each other because it was somehow against the conventions of the time. And then have to kind of talk that through. In Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, they wait till Big Daddy is dying. In Fiddler, they manage to get around to the conversation earlier. Well, that's another one. Let me try another. How about MASH? Talk about the countervailing forces for and against community in MASH.
Well, Hawkeye Pierce and his sidekick obviously are a quality of their own, and the jerk that they live with, and his bedmate, the nurse.
Hot Lips.
Hot Lips, Houlihan.
Yeah.
And they can't live with him, and they can't live without him. Because they celebrate from time to time together and get involved in situations where they're thrown together.
Yeah.
And they are together.
Yeah.
And yet they can't stand each other in both ways.
That's right. They particularly when they were dealing with Frank Burns and his affair with Hot Lips. Once, what's his name, the Bostonian shows up.
Charles
Emerson Winchester III. Then it's a little bit different sort of thing. Yeah. Some more out of MASH.
I think the real baseline of the of so many episodes in that series was the conflict between the narrowing from the fact that they're a military organization and they have narrow views of everything. To Hawkeye's view that, we're here, we don't want to be here. I don't want to be patching up people, war is wrong. It's a dichotomy of the narrowing of the occupation versus what he'd really like to be doing.
Yeah. And I think particularly it is the attempt to make something humane out of an insane situation.
I was thinking, too, that the Hawkeye's attitude about the enemy, whenever they're North Korean soldiers that end up in their hospital there, he's always ready to treat them, and there's always somebody to say, but that's the enemy, and we shouldn't treat them.
That they shouldn't be treated, that's right. Can you pick some more?
There is the respect they have for each other, even though they don't agree.
Enormous respect. You know, can you imagine... Under any but those direst of circumstances, can you imagine a Klinger getting by with what Klinger gets by with? but they do in that setting. Try this a little different way. Pick out the episodes that you remember the best from MASH. Which ones have stuck with you as having the most impact? While you're thinking, I'll tell one. One from... Oh, go ahead, Sobey.
What was the name of that?
The doctor,
the one who had the
affair
with
Hot Lips. Oh, Frank Burns.
Remember when that group of musicians came in?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That was. Yeah. And he took care of them, and then they finally were sent away, and then were gone.
Yeah.
Oh, that was Winchester.
But see, that's a potent one. Some more. The one I remember was Christmas Eve, when Hawkeye lost a wounded soldier after struggling to keep him alive. And he's sitting there at 11:30 or 11:45, and BJ says, sign the death certificate and let's get out of here. And Hawkeye won't do it. And BJ says, why not? And he said, nobody should die on Christmas Eve. I'm going to wait till after midnight and then I'll sign it. That business of trying to make a little sense out of just a chaotic situation. Or Colonel Potter giving his favorite horse away to this old Korean. I guess what I want to say is that MASH is of the character of saying to people, you've got to get beyond your narrowness. Life is too desperate to be able to indulge. You can be idiosyncratic, you can do nutty things, and sometimes you'll have to keep your sanity. But you can't leave each other, you can't go away. And there is that, there, community somehow isn't going to happen except in those situations where we say to each other, you can't go away.
That's the situation we're in now.
Yeah.
You know, the whole planet. We can't go away. And we're all connected.
And somehow we have to be convinced of that. The phrase I sometimes like to use is, there is no separate destiny anymore. But we somehow have to convince ourselves of that. When somebody talks about a winnable war, you know, that's wild. Talk about a separate destiny that says some could not only survive but win. Some older images, and I suspect not as many of you will have seen them, but let's hope enough. Let me try them and see. How many of you either read Bill Golding's book, Lord of the Flies, or saw the movie? Enough to use that one. How many saw the movie Blue Lagoon? All right, scratch the Blue Lagoon side of it. We'll go with the Lord of the Flies. But, let's try Lord of the Flies. It's written in 1956, and sometimes when something is written is important. It's written at the height of what seemed to be a very placid, calm, optimistic time. Bill Golding, remember the literary device is that you take a bunch of English choir boys, cathedral choir boys, they're going to go on a tour, they're on a plane, somehow the plane manages to crash in such a way that all the adults are killed off and only the children survive. And when you choose the choir boys, you have of course chosen the most civilized folks around. Surely they can manage. And Lord of the Flies is the story about how that degenerates into a vicious, murderous kind of thing that is only rescued because some adults show up from the outside world. When Golding was asked what he intended by all of that, he said, we have to know that left to our own devices, we do not have the ability to hold together a civilized and humane way of dealing with each other. There is the requirement that there be outside source of strength and outside source of meaning. Golding was a Christian. He was talking about the ability to bring in the gospel from the outside, to bring it into a situation. I think it's one of the most depressing anti-community stories I have ever seen. I was going to use Blue Lagoon the other way around, you know. It shows two people who managed to create community. But you didn't see the movie.
I did.
Yeah.
I didn't think you were talking about something that was this generation. It sounded like you were running
back.
Brooke Shields, yeah.
Yeah.
Did I just make a confession? Yeah, that was the Brooke Shields one.
What about the Shanghai compound? Have you read that?
No, I'm not able to respond. Can others? Because feel free now to bring in. Yeah, go ahead. David?
I don't know what a response would be called for, but I've read Shanghai compound.
Can you illustrate out of that toward the subject we're talking about? Go ahead.
I haven't read it, but I understood that it was a degeneration, and that's what I was curious
okay.
about.
Okay, I see what you're at. David?
Yeah, I can offer an illustration out of that. Chantham Compound is Langdon Gilkey, a mature theologian 30 years after an experience of being a prisoner of war in a Japanese concentration camp in China. And the Japanese were smart enough to know that there was going to be a lot of complaints about the distribution of resources here, so they said to the prisoners, who were all British and American missionaries, you would think very civilized people, that they had these three buildings and they had to decide how to house themselves in those three buildings. The Japanese weren't going to assign rooms, they were going to give the buildings to the group, and the group decided that they would form a committee, in typical Western fashion. The committee would assign rooms, and then there would be a complaint system set up, whereby if you had a complaint, you could report it to the committee. And Gilkey was chairman of the housing committee, and talks about how he got no end of trouble trying to resolve complaints until one day a group of people came to him and said, we represent 24 people living in a room, and we're very crowded. And across the hall from us is a room of 22 people. And one day we tricked him to be out of the room. And one of us went in there and measured it. It's exactly the same size as our room. And Gilkey says he said a prayer of thanks to God, that finally God had sent him a complaint that he wouldn't have any trouble resolving. Because it was so clear. Two rooms exactly the same size. One's got 22, the other's got 24. And he thought it would be obvious how you justly resolve that situation, until he went along to the room of 22 and listened while they pointed out that they did not think it would be just in their already overcrowded condition to have to take on another roommate.
Yeah. Fabulous. Reminds me of the famous exercise in the 1950s about what happened if you stocked a bomb shelter to support a certain number of people long enough to survive the first effects of a bomb, and then one more person tried to get in than you were stocked for. Mm-hmm. Remember that kind of debate that went on? Mm-hmm. Crazy stuff.
Well, Ron, the book I read recently that really at least helped me understand inclusiveness and exclusiveness was Fischner's book, The Drifters.
Yes.
And I hadn't read that for a long time, but it's just so right on in terms of understanding the whole Vietnam era and the generation of youth that came through that time, myself included, in terms of the distances that were between parents and society and values. And I thought Michener did an excellent job in being very objective about both sides of the fence on that one.
Okay, those are the kinds of illustrations we need. Let me try changing something. How many of you have seen one or another of these? Have either seen the sequel Star Wars, either Star Wars, any one of the three in there? Particularly, how about Return of the Jedi? All right. Star Trek the movie, or Close Encounters of the Third Kind? Between the three, we ought to manage. I think there are some interesting relational pieces in those. I haven't decided whether they are in fact just space age westerns for diversion. There is certainly a good chunk of that in there. But I'm fascinated by some relational byplays in them. Let me try them, and I'm not even sure I can defend these, but I'll test them and see. I think that one of the interesting byplays in Star Trek is the business of our curiosity to know whether Mr. Spock in fact has more irrational human leanings than he betrays or thinks he has. You notice how often we end up with that business of Spock, quite often over against the doctor, whose nickname is Bones. I've forgotten what his real name is.
McCoy,
yeah. How McCoy will be very passionate about something, and that Spock is very cool. But somehow there's always that pushing around, and there are times when Spock comes very close to getting beyond loyalty, which he has plenty of, and commitment to the mission, which he has a great deal of. But every so often you see that edge about caring that reaches to what could be called love. Interesting to watch the Spock scene. In The Return of the Jedi, it's much more obvious. The question, and for those who haven't seen it, I promise not to spoil it, but at least you know, the question that already came into the movie, because you got hints of it at the end of the last one, was if Darth Vader is in fact Luke Skywalker's father, is there any humanity left in him, or has he so completely sold out that he's unredeemable. Darth Vader is the Hitler figure in that whole thing. And that fascinating little piece about whether there's any humanity left in Darth Vader, or in Close Encounters, it's of a different, more upbeat kind, and that's of the kid who has the affinity with the people from outside the system, and who is not afraid, who is not scared of something just because it's different. Well, let's just see if you can kick into any of that, the science fiction sort of stuff.
I wasn't going to talk about this because I haven't seen any of those, but it seems to me that the movie E.T. would be
E.T. would fit the same thing.
Because it said both inclusiveness and exclusiveness.
Yeah.
I just think it's absolutely awesome that you get to see all these movies.
My understanding is that if one has an addiction, you have to find a way to justify it and then do it with the...
When you're an executive assistant to the president, you know, you gotta find something to do.
That's right.
I think the important thing to remember is that this does demonstrate that it's a good thing to watch TV and go to the movies. And I like that move to Virgin also, so I'm glad my wife is hearing this.
You missed the line we used maybe in the very first session. George Forel got me into this business of using art forms as a way of understanding. And it is Forel who quoted somebody else. I wish I knew who this somebody else was. Forel quoted somebody else who said, it's not that artists are prophets. It isn't that they foresee the future. It's just that they get to the future before the rest of us. Yeah. That's the piece.
What does that mean?
How dare you ask that? What does that mean? I know what Forel means by it, and that is that generally the front edge of the future is already in the present, but we tend not to recognize it because we are so conditioned by the way things have been. McLuhan says it in a cruder way, using a picture of a car with a rear view mirror, and then the caption underneath it says, we mostly approach the future through a rear view mirror. That's the same kind of line. Artists are people. Let me try, for example, the business of identity crisis. When artists, by artists I mean writers and movie makers and so forth, when artists started telling us about identity crises in the early 60s, I have to tell you that frankly it sounded to me like an aesthetic weakness that rich kids could afford. It was not until Fairmont later that the whole business of how identity itself was being brought into question became obvious to some of the rest of us. I was slow getting into that one. I now understand, I think, that the very core of our identity has been challenged and that it never will be the same.
I was going to say, I thought it was really interesting in Return of the Jedi when you have the final confrontation between Darth and Luke, that confrontation really depended on what Luke Skywalker believed or didn't believe about Darth. It wasn't the power struggle that you were expecting or was in the others. And I thought it was just an intriguing new twist, a theme of good and evil.
Yes.
And of how that's carried out in our literature, especially that genre.
Yeah, it's a classic on good and evil. For those who are willing to admit to being old enough, our generation of that was the old Lone Ranger radio series. And particularly, it was the line at the beginning that said, from out of the past come the hoofbeats of the great horse Silver. And what was the rest of the line?
Out of the past come the thundering horse beats, or the hoofbeats of the great horse Silver and the...
I'm missing a line earlier than that. It'll hit me later when it's too late. But it's this sense of the righteousness, that the white rider coming to set things right. Somebody, Holly.
I wanted to say that in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you see something that's probably common in some others and I can't think of right now, that besides the people that are kind of putting up with strangeness and people and aliens that are different than them. There are people who are compelled to unite with those people. And an example would be the main character in Close Encounters. I mean, that's his life is this total compulsion to connect with the aliens.
He cannot let
go. I think that's relating to your idea of some people being kind of on the edge of the future, that maybe that's the edge.
Yep, I think that's right.
But it's interesting, I think, that Close Encounters and E.T. and all of these are pretty much the first major science fiction type of movies that don't make that out there the obvious enemy.
Yes.
All these Buck Rogers and going clear back, it was always Earthman versus them.
Yeah, even Star Trek, it was always bad guys out there, or nearly always. You're right. You're right, very much there. Close Encounters particularly suggests that we may be the enemy, and that those who come in from the outside are not.
But then here, still, I think we kind of fall into that same kind of nemesis also.
Yeah. Go ahead.
With messenger coming, and the basic message being that people on planet Earth better learn how to live with each other, because this other planet had the robots, which were their police force. As long as they lived in peace with each other, everything was fine. But the robots were programmed that at any time that they would do any violence to another citizen, then the robots would go into action. Dangerous, but still.
Old movie that shows up on cable every so often. Let me change to a different. Anybody want to share a different movie or book or TV program, or I'll probably introduce another.
I was thinking of these movies in that they were letting the frontier.
Yeah.
You know, it's a new frontier that comes into consciousness. They're looking at something new, and I think. Our entire human race is always searching for a frontier to push against.
Yeah.
And in a lot of these movies, we find ourselves pushing against that frontier of space or extraterrestrial beings, and coming to a relationship with them, and thinking, gee, this is good, you know. This frontier that we're seeking, we've had before, and it's comfortable.
That's right. In fact, Star Trek uses the phrase "a new frontier" right in it. That's one of those good news, bad news things. The good news is that it does have a grain of optimism in it. It does say maybe this is not yet the pinnacle of social development. Maybe something else is possible. The other side of that is, it is a classic way of escaping facing the issues where they are. It's not just the immorality of the amount of money we spend on space exploration while people are starving, but it's also the business of distracting ourselves, of yet another way to avoid the obvious. Yeah.
Another comment I was going to make to kind of follow up Chris on the news. Them that we're seeing, another theme that runs through all of this is a fear of the unknown.
Yes.
And how that's reacted to it. E.T., what blocks the relationships from developing or happening is that whole fear of the unknown. So if you see E.T. as this creature that you can't know or can't relate to because it's alien, then you never get past the fear
of
the relationship.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I look at it like, what's the reality of this? I have a little boy in E.T. How many little boys are there in the world who will relate to something that is foreign to him or her?
Yeah.
Little boys, little girls. How many people are there that will relate to some other flavor of person that is foreign? Very few. The reality is that mankind is different from one culture to another culture. So there will always be a certain level of separateness.
Yes.
You know, sociological experts, I'm sure, would go into that. So the question that I then turn to is, these Ninth Level Theories are very good, idyllically, but it doesn't always fit the way we are separate. And, you know, we can say we want to help people of other nations, and it's certainly valid, good Christian thing to do, good humanitarian thing to do. We can say that war is bad, well, it is. We can say the defense industry should be changed to feed mankind. Well, not so simple. Put the defense industry out of business, and the immediate thing that will happen is we'll change from, I don't know, what are we, 10% unemployment today, or whatever the number is, it'll go to 30-40% unemployment. So we will have far more starving people. It is not quite so simplistic as I think I'm hearing over the last few days. So it's the program at hand, though it is idyllically desirable that all of mankind on the whole earth, no matter what culture, no matter what intellectual level, no matter what, be able to get along. But where's reality with that?
Where's reality? One of the issues, though, is whether or not we can reach a point where differentness does not have to become the occasion for exclusion. Is it possible to be different and yet be of one flesh? And the answer ought to be yes. We like it that way in marriage. We ought to be able to like it in some other relationships.
Logically.
I just wanted to respond in part to what was just mentioned in the context of E.T. It seems to me that that movie faces very squarely the question that has just been asked. And it faces it in the center of the film when the great scene on the playground takes place. And the skeptical neighborhood cronies, the neighborhood gang, first sees the risen E.T. And Elliot says, we've got to get him back to his spaceship. And, Elliot says, we've got to get him back to the spaceship. The boys say, and one of the boys steps forward and says, well, why doesn't he just beam up? Having watched Star Trek as a kind of documentary all his life, to which Elliot responds, in a way, very directly to this gentleman's insight, this is reality, Greg. The whole audience laughs, and in a way, the joke is a very complicated joke because Greg has made the mistake all of his life of thinking that Star Trek is reality, and we laugh because we feel the force of Elliot's rebuke to Greg, this is reality, but we're caught up in this artistic vision, which, as you say, anticipates the future, so that we're fairly convinced that this really is reality, even though we're standing to the film in the same way that Greg is standing towards Star Trek. So it's a kind of a wonderful centerpiece in that movie that addresses the question of reality.
Would somebody be willing to quickly see if the library has a copy of The Velveteen Rabbit? If you do, there's a passage in there that I would read. Would you please? Yeah, that one is real life. The Velveteen Rabbit.
Thank you.
All right.
Another thing that occurred to me about E.T. just now listening to this is that the lines that were so readily accepted and brought great laughter and applause were the exceptional put-downs of the children to each other. At least my perception is remembering that part of the whole. The line, zero charisma. In other words, here's this jerk with zero charisma, and the other put down, I don't even have the courage to speak up there. There's one that I didn't even hear, and I've been asking a lot of people in that exchange. And what it said to me is that there's a lot of approval and acceptance of that kind of put down.
Yeah. Well, let me just
go ahead and
respond to that.
Yeah.
I think you're right, but I think that the movie shows this wonderful movement. After all, it's not unrealistic for Elliot to understand E.T. Elliot's alien himself.
He is alienated from his brothers and sisters, who are, as this gentleman reminds us, putting him down. He's alienated. His father has abandoned him in the same way that Elliot's, in the same way that E.T.'s people have abandoned him. The neighborhood gang won't let him play, and they won't let him play a game called Universe. The first thing in the movie is, you can't just join this universe in the middle. So Elliot's an outsider. And so, of course, he and the other outsider comes to him. What happens as the course of the film goes on is that there are fewer and fewer put-downs. The very presence of E.T. reconciles people one to another. At the end of the film, all the principal characters are there. The mother with a potential new husband and father, the NASA man, who shares Elliot's dream, the neighborhood boys, who now love Elliot and key them, Elliot and his sibs. And so the whole movement of the film is from put down, fight, alienation, loneliness, to reunion, reconciliation, and so forth. And that kind of language drops out by the end of the film.
Yeah, so I agree with that. My notion was where the crowd was, not
yeah.
the film.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I see, because the crowd laughed.
I don't think the crowd is the theater that the film moves.
You mean the audience in the theater?
Exactly.
Yes. Spooky. What audiences in theaters yeah. do sometimes.
And on the note of inclusiveness with that movie, it was banned overseas in a certain country.
It was?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sweden.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think the point is that you see what you want to see as the point that you are in your own culture, in your own thought. I mean, everybody can go to that movie and see a different thing. People can go, and if they get a kick out of put downs, they'll see put downs. Mm-hmm. If they get a kick out of people being reunited, they'll see that aspect. For me, the most powerful part of it was when E.T. was dying and all the medical technology could not save him, but one little boy saying, "I love you," was all that was needed to bring him back to life. And I think that's the exchange between all people, too, that's...
Okay, anyway. Let me change art form for a minute. Just one, how many of you have seen Gandhi, the movie? A scene out of Gandhi that I think is just powerful is when that terribly angry Hindu man is standing over Gandhi during that hunger fast, and Gandhi's advice to him is, go out and adopt an orphaned Muslim boy and raise him as a Muslim. That terribly, terribly hard advice. But what Gandhi was saying is, you will not reach beyond your hatred till you learn to love somebody that your instincts tell you you ought to hate. That's powerful stuff about one flesh. Promise some of you, yes, Helen.
Well, I was just going to suggest one more film.
Go ahead.
That was Shogun.
Oh, yeah.
Can you think of
Shogun, that's that miniseries.
Outside in a closed society.
Yeah.
Japan was
involved. I promised some of you that I was going to makes reference to 1 Corinthians 7, and I want to do it without insisting that this is what the passage really means. But I think it's a very interesting thought. The chapter starts with Paul responding to what had been obviously a piece of correspondence from the Corinthian congregation, or a set of questions sent by courier, or whatever. He's responding now to some questions that have to do with marriage involving Christians. And one needs to remember that Paul believed that the end of the world was very near, and that his advice to people who were not married saying, why bother, and to those who were saying, well, you might as well, you know, just don't mess with human institutions now because the end is very near. You have to grant that as you get into the Corinthian material. But then he's been asked a more specific question, and that was, if I'm a Christian and I'm married to somebody who doesn't want to be a Christian, should I stay married or not?
And you can just hear reverberating in your head that old passage about not being unequally yoked with unbelievers. And you know, that whole business about does it contaminate me to stay married, or that sort of thing. Paul, in response to that, carefully says that the Lord hasn't given him any particular word. His way of saying that is, to the rest I say, not the Lord. Or if you translate that a little bit differently, it says, I don't have anything from the Lord, but my own advice to you is. Okay, granted then it's only advice, and that he's already said it's not inspired. The advice clearly is you ought to stay married. If the unbelieving partner is willing, stay married. Okay, let that stand. It's a byplay in the text that I want to come to. The byplay is when Paul, reflecting his own theological understanding of how God deals with humanity, Paul says, for the unbelieving husband is consecrated through his wife. The unbelieving wife is consecrated through her husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean. But as it is, they are holy. And then a little later on in the same passage, wife, how do you know whether you will save your husband? Husband, how do you know whether you will save your wife? Now, in the classic American individualistic style, what that really suggests is that the believing partner ought to nag the unbeliever through 40 years of marriage until the partner gives in and becomes a Christian. I exaggerate to get the point made. But that's not what the passage says. What the passage says is, if we are one flesh, my wife and I, and I'm not a believer, but she is, God will respect the two of us as one, and for the sake of her faith, I also will be saved, and our children will be. What it says is God does not deal with us as individually, as our own modern American mentality suggests, that he deals with us in groups, that he deals with us in families. In the Eucharist Sunday night, the Abraham text was read to us, where Abraham bargains with God about the business about, for the sake of 50, would you leave the city alone? How about 45, 40, 30, and so forth? You can turn around and say God already knew how it was going to turn out, that they wouldn't even find 10. And so it was all an exercise in futility, but I don't think it was. Because you got to think about the fact there was another option. The other option was for Abraham to say to God, why don't you give me time to get the 50 out of there? You know, and then you can go ahead and destroy the rest. But that isn't the way God operates. He is not willing to cut so sharply. Now, you're welcome to turn around and quote to me the passage out of Matthew that says, there shall be two working in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. But that's a little bit different kind of passage. But here in the marriage text, in a text about marriage, he says, you are no longer two people, but one flesh. So he will treat it as one unit. I think you can start to come back from that and generalize and not do violence to God in saying that he is distressed when we draw too sharp a line between ourselves and others. That we are in fact one flesh with all the rest of humanity. And that the problem for us is that we have thought of ourselves as too distinct. Well, I'll give you a chance to react to that.
One of the things that bothers me is that we accept the fact that we don't have to try.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I think it's for our own good for us to be inclusive, really.
Yes.
It's good for us.
Marilyn and I used to comment that it was almost immoral the way we would load up our kid, drive all the way across Denver, drive past 500,000 people to get to the house of friends to play bridge. You know, what does it say when you drive past 500,000 people to get to the house of friends? It says something kind of strange. It was a good friendship, and sometimes they were good cards. But there was something not right about that, as contrasted to when I was a kid on a farm, and we put up with our neighbors, even the ones we really didn't like.
Because we knew we had to live and work together. You had to thrash together, you had to shell corn together, you had to sometimes clear the highway together. It's too bad we've gotten to the point where we can go past each other. It's too bad that we don't have, that we don't insist on our dealing with each other and somehow holding it together. Holly.
Well, you just said, and she said over here, that inclusiveness is good for us. I didn't used to think that was quite that obviously true, because you'd be around somebody who believed differently on a very important subject than you did. I did, I'll get very personal here. And my temptation was always to talk them into my viewpoint, and I didn't know what to do with them if I wasn't trying to talk them into my viewpoint. I couldn't just shut up and listen to their viewpoint and leave it there. And I guess what finally happened to me was I realized that I needed to trust God more, that God's power could work just by me caring about a person and being with that person, that somehow that would have some power. And if they needed their mind changed, God would somehow work in that, and ultimately that would happen.
Let me try to say that back theologically. We have tended to think that we had to negotiate unity, which meant that we had to try to persuade each other to a common viewpoint, instead of understanding that the unity we have is a very radical unity that has been negotiated in the blood of Christ. That's a given. What we have to find out a way to do is to encourage each other's separate gifts and insights. Not to scratch the word separate. Encourage each other's gifts and insights so that we help each other be stewards of what we have been given in the world. Did anybody, do you have any luck with the Velveteen Rabbit? All right, thanks for trying. If I can lay my hands on it later, I'll try to bring it in somewhere. I can do part of it by memory. It's the rabbit and an old skin horse and a bunch of other toys are laying in the toy box. And the passage says something about what is real, said the rabbit, as he lay in the box. And then the skin horse starts to answer, and those were the lines I wanted. Skin horse says, real is, and the rabbit says, does it happen all of a sudden or over a period of time? Does it have the sun ringing bells and flashing lights and so forth? And then the skin horse says, no, it doesn't happen all of a sudden or like that. It happens gradually over a long time. It comes as you are loved, not just held or looked at, but loved until the fur is rubbed off and your ears droop and your tail falls off, and I've forgotten some of the other lines, and until you are not beautiful anymore. Now help me with that line.
Except
to someone who loves you. Now somehow that gets caught, that phrase, except to someone who loves you. If there is a way, that's what Gandhi was trying to say to the Hindu. If there is a way you can look at a Muslim child and say not that's a Muslim, but that's a child. If there's a way you can somehow say you're not ugly because I love you, or in the words of that song of a few years ago, he ain't heavy, he's my brother. If there's a way to get at claiming one flesh with people we have not been used to claiming it with, we are then on the road toward a more inclusive community. Art, are we?
We're just about there.
5 minutes.
2 minutes. 3 minutes.
The more I know about an enemy, or a supposed enemy, or someone who's different, the more I get to know them, the more I love that person. Yeah. And so instead of isolating them or shutting them out of my life, oftentimes, in fact, I find that people that turn me off right away are the ones that are really good friends afterwards, or work hard with that.
Jim.
Last week we saw a program on some documentaries there was a man they were interviewing who was now a Mennonite, and he was explaining how he became to be a Mennonite, and he said that he had previously worked...
Amish.
He previously worked, what was it?
He worked as an executioner for the CIA in Vietnam.
He killed the guys and take the information they were supposed to be transporting. Mm-hmm. Just take it off of them and go. And he's done this ruthlessly, just completely ruthlessly, for years. And one day, he took the information out of this fellow's pocket and out came a picture. And he was of a Catholic background. Out came this picture in the rosary. And he looked at the picture, and it was a picture of this man standing there with his little four-year-old girl. And he had a four-year-old girl. And the man himself was Catholic. And he just looked at this man, and sort of this whole identification came over him as relating to this person, you know, and not as the enemy or whatever else. And he went back and tried to change duties and went in and out of different things in this great struggle he was having over this particular incident. And eventually he was discharged, or he left the service, and through another series of trying to get back into society and trying to marry, and he just could not give up this one incident, and has now taken on the Amish way of life because it is a way of life that is nonviolent and that is very inclusive and all of these things. But that one incident completely, it was that what you were saying, you know, all of a sudden you identify with somebody who's otherwise an enemy, you know.
Time for one more real quickie. Anybody want to get a last thing?
It would seem to me, from my experience in some churches that are, say, universally white, universally Scandinavian, okay, that the chief thing that separates peoples is ideas and ideology.
Yes.
Okay.
And lifestyles that grow out of it.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah. Whereas if we could get to the point where we get to the basic idea or the basic thought of commonality, we'd be a lot better off. But how do you get there? How do you get there without having to convince, you know, be in a position of trying to convince someone not to believe how I do, but you could believe how you do, and I believe how I do, but we're both, you know, we have a relationship.
Yeah. I don't know how to even respond to that quickly. Let me say one thing, though. And here I'm citing from the inaugural speech of Lloyd Spensby when he was installed as president of Lutheran Northwestern Seminaries. Remember that being at the service that day at Central Lutheran in Minneapolis, this would be some 8 years ago, and a president of a seminary on an inauguration day kind of makes a statement about priorities, right? And Lutheran Northwestern, it's hard to say just what all everybody expected that day, but I remember the kind of disappointment that rippled through the audience that day when Lloyd Spensby said, I think the main challenge to our church in the years immediately ahead is to deal creatively with the issue of equality between men and women. And the distress that went through the audience, I think, had the feel of saying, surely you can draw attention to something more important than that. And he stuck with it, and he went on, and what he said was, if we can't manage that which is in our own churches and our own families, if we can't manage to develop a new relationship of respect and equality right here at home, how can we ever hope to manage it anywhere else? I think he was right, in spite of the fact that people were disappointed. There is the sense, and I think that's sort of what you're saying, we got to start. We dare not get caught just dealing with ourselves. That's demonic. But we have to take advantage of the opportunities we have to become more inclusive by cutting through the things that have excluded. And that will be the learning ground for us for the greater inclusiveness we need.
Even at times where the inclusiveness of ancestry, of religion, of so many things are so obvious. We don't take those into a sufficient account. No. We'd rather have a difference than a common.
No. Well, Mark.
Thank you very much, Roger, for taking us through some really interesting terrain here. I personally appreciate that very much, and I gather from the open eyes and
Discussion out there, that speaks for you too. I want to thank myself too for ringing that gong at the beginning. I think together we made a great team.